Hi, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of the Backwater Entrepreneur Podcast and Show. My name is Jack, and I'm your host, and this is another special. You'll see we're in a different surroundings, and in a special episode, I bring along a guest, and in this episode, I have the distinct pleasure of talking to Jonathan Beyer, right?
That's right.
And basically, John is a recovering venture capitalist investor. And he has been working in Silicon Valley for about 32 years. And he is running a big company. He has been investing in lots of small other businesses. He's doing a lot of consulting with startups worldwide. And we have the pleasure of having him here on the Backwater Entrepreneur Podcast. John, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
So, John, you say you are a recovering venture capitalist. What does that mean, a recovering venture?
Well, it means several things. The first thing it means is I used to invest. I don't anymore. So when people come to me and say, I want money, I simply say, I'm not investing. I'm happy to give you help, advice, counsel, but I'm not investing. Secondly, it means that I bring the perspective of an investor. And yes, I've been a serial entrepreneur. I'm founder and CEO of two venture-backed companies, both of which had liquidity events. But I also bring the mindset of an investor. And very often, entrepreneurs are really good at thinking about their product. Sometimes they're okay at thinking about their market and the business. But they often fail to understand the investor's perspective, and particularly for companies who are looking to raise capital, getting the benefit of the investor's perspective is really critical.
Fantastic. And let's just one more step back. So why did you stop investing?
It stopped being fun. It stopped being fun. It was at a period of time where there was too much venture capital money out there. The valuations were too high. People didn't have real businesses. You were being asked to invest in something which was simply an idea, and there really was very little behind it. And that stopped being fun for me. And so I decided it was time to drop out and try something else.
Okay, so let's go back to the basics. So this is a podcast about mostly entrepreneurship, but we also include and have a base of listeners who are in startups. What is the difference between entrepreneurship and startup? And we talk about this in a lot of episodes. So for you, are all entrepreneurs also startups, or are all startups entrepreneurs? So where is the difference between that?
Well, I think, you know, entrepreneurs start companies. Startups, it's kind of a vague definition. You know, there are early stage startups and then there are later stage startups. And so the startup just refers to the entity, and maybe you're talking about how far along it is. But you don't have startups without entrepreneurs, and entrepreneurs, you can be an entrepreneur, but it's better to be an entrepreneur and be starting something, hopefully.
Some of my guests and some of the opinions about the difference between startups and entrepreneurs is a startup needs to be scalable. So like infinitely scalable or exponentially scalable in order not to be a regular business. So is that also in your opinion?
Well, you know, I think there's a definition of companies that are venture financeable. And I think that is a smaller subset of the startup world. And venture financeable companies, in order to have it attractive and have the economics make sense for both the investor and the startup, they have to have large market potential. They have to be able to grow and scale quickly. But there are people who start businesses that never raise outside capital. That may not grow to be multi-billion dollars in revenue or size. And those are legitimate startups. They are companies, they're creating value, they're providing product or service, and that's perfectly fine. And so I'm not going to make a value judgment as one is better than the other. They're certainly slightly different.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's. You mentioned that some companies are investable and some maybe are not in that sense. So for all of those startups that are just beginning or thinking about getting an investment, what makes the company appealing to investors?
Oh boy! How long do we have for this podcast?
Let's put it in short.
Oh, we got to put it in short form. Okay, so I think there are several ways you can go about answering that question. Companies which can scale based on additional capital are attractive investments. Companies that will grow to be large in size and value, where the economics work for everybody, that makes sense. There are a lot of other companies where the market potential is much smaller. Throwing more capital into the company really doesn't help the company grow. And so, what is appealing to an investor is where I can put money in and I can turn the wheels faster. So that money not only helps the company, but it helps me because I've invested at a low valuation and the company is worth more at a high valuation. The other piece of that is, as an investor, I need to be able to find a company that I can put money in. Hopefully it can grow in scale and increase in value, but then I have a path to liquidity. Because after I invest, one of the key questions I always ask, and usually I even ask it before I make the investment, is how am I going to make money? And I can't make money unless the company is sold or the company is publicly listed. And so some companies are better suited to being bought. Some companies are better suited to going public. And other companies, other kinds of businesses, actually aren't really well suited for either. And so that category of company usually doesn't get an investment from professional venture investors.
When we talk about investments, you mentioned numerous times that it's all about how we're going to make money for the investor. So in order to make a good decision on whether to invest or not.
Right.
In most cases, in your experience, what happens, is it better for the company in early stages to seek an investment, or when they have something already developed or in some sort of MVP or later stage? So what is the kind of the best stage to search for an investment?
Well, I'm going to answer a slightly different question. When are you most likely to get investment?
Okay.
You're most likely to get investment when you have a product, when you have a clear understanding of the market, when you have some indications of customer traction, which means people are buying your product or about to buy your product or committed to buying your product. Those are times when it's going to be easier to raise money. You're going to have a choice of more investors rather than less investors, and it's going to be a more efficient process, and you're probably going to raise money at a higher valuation. There's an earlier stage where it's harder, and perhaps there's a stage which it's almost impossible to raise capital, because even though somebody may have a brilliant idea, very often it's hard to get an investor who's going to invest in that idea, brilliant or otherwise, until there's enough traction in terms of product and in terms of customers and market validation.
Mm-hmm. And going back to the entrepreneurship side, back to the people who are running the startups, no matter if they are searching for investments or not, what are the most common mistakes that people running startups do?
And again, I asked the question, how long do we have for this podcast? So, there are a lot of reasons why companies fail. And they range from founders not getting along. Having co-founders is a good thing because building a team of people who brings diverse background, experience, and skills helps increase the probability of success. But when founders don't get along, it gets ugly, and very often that's the cause of companies failing. The bigger issue often is that people build a product or go after a market and there is no market.
Mm-hmm.
They think there's an opportunity, they think there's a need, and it turns out they're wrong. And sometimes they're just wrong, and sometimes they're very wrong.
And what is the advice for those people who think they have a product?
Well, I can tell you I've heard a lot of people talk about MVP, mm-hmm. minimally viable product, and I've talked to a lot of people who are hell-bent on building the MVP long before they talk to people to understand the market need, the problem that really that the customer has, and the product requirements. And it's a key missing step that I see among entrepreneurs here, as I do in many other parts of the world. But I think my gratuitous advice to entrepreneurs is ask questions, do market analysis, get feedback from people early before you even start building your MVP. Mm-hmm. Your MVP, yes, your MVP will give you additional feedback, and it will ultimately help you to better define the market and what product you deliver. But there's a missing step there, and it gets companies, it gets entrepreneurs in trouble.
You mentioned that a part of the problems that startups are having is the team falls apart.
The team falls apart.
So what makes a great team? And in some cases, do you see that people get in, have an idea, and they need to gather a team around that idea? So what is your advice for searching for the right team?
Okay, so there are two questions there. You know, the first one is what makes for a good team?
Yep.
The same things that makes for a great marriage, you know. People who know each other, they understand their strengths and weaknesses, they bring complementary background and skills and experience, and they're able to communicate effectively. Mm-hmm. In terms of finding co-founders, you know, networking, talking to people, getting referrals, being clear as to what it is you're doing, being able to tell the short story, not the long story, and being passionate about what you're doing all help you in trying to identify co-founders. It's not an easy process, but I certainly, in the short time I've been here, I've met a lot of people who are interested in doing something and they don't have the idea. On the other hand, I've met a number of people who have some good ideas, but you know, they are sole founders and they really need to surround themselves with a team.
Mm-hmm. The problem in most people having a team is making them, well, work for the idea as if it was their own. So basically to dig, grind for the purpose of that idea. For those people who are solo entrepreneurs and or solo idea founders, how do you think they should sell the idea? Nobody's going to work for your idea as you are going to do.
Right.
So it's your baby. So, and if you have not only co-founders, but also employees. So what about motivation? So what makes the best motivation?
So I think, you know, and I don't see that problem in Silicon Valley. When people come together, they are truly co-founders. And so it's not one person's idea and everybody else works for the founder. When I talk about co-founders, I'm talking about people who are equals in many ways, including very often in equity ownership. And so if you're a founder of a company and you own 100% of the company and you're going to give 1% to each of three co-founders, you're missing the point.
Yep.
Now, you know, often in Silicon Valley, often in other companies around the world, you know, the co-founders, even if they weren't, if they didn't have the original idea, they are all equal, assuming and have equal ownership in the company. They may have different roles, and there's always somebody who's the CEO who makes the final decision. But in terms of ownership, among founders as well as among employees, the goal is to have put in a structure where everybody feels a ownership in the company and the opportunity, and at least in many of the places that I've worked, that's a great way to build common interest and excitement around the company and the opportunity.
In the startup world, especially in the investments, and when we're talking about equity and team, there is always kind of the thought when we are adding people to the team. So whether should we hire them or should we give them equity? So
the answer is you are hiring people.
Yeah.
If they're full-time people, you're hiring them. Now, how you compensate them, whether they're getting cash compensation or strictly equity, is a function of where the company stands.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes the company has no cash. The people you have joining can join on a full-time or a part-time basis, and they're willing to work without near-term cash compensation. There are other times that you bring people in on a part-time or a consulting basis, and then you figure out how to compensate them. And again, you know, what's the mix of cash, compensation, and equity? And it's a function of, you know, it's always a negotiation, and it's a function of what the company has and what people's requirements are. I've occasionally run into people where two of the three co-founders are taking no cash, but they have a larger equity stake in the company, and one of the co-founders needs current income, and so they have traded off some equity in the company for some cash compensation.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, trying to be flexible and adaptable, assuming you have the right people, the right talents, the right mix of people who can help you be successful, is trying to put together that recipe that hopefully will give you a cake that rises and doesn't fall flat.
Going back to investments, so we often hear, and I heard also you saying, that getting investments is often based on the team that is presenting and that is running a startup. So in most cases, do people with, the solo entrepreneurs, solo startup owners, or bigger teams. So what makes a team that is more likely to appeal to an investor?
Well, and I don't want to say that team is everything. It's certainly an important element, but, you know, making sure there's a real market, you're filling a real need, making sure that you've positioned yourself uniquely relative to competition or competitive alternatives is equally important. In terms of the team, you know, finding people who can work together, people who bring the requisite experience and skills, both technical business experience as well as, market and customer contacts and relationships, all of those things factor in. A passionate CEO, a charismatic CEO, goes a long way. And I've seen people who have little experience but are very long on charm and charisma raise money, and other people who, you know, perhaps have more experience but are not as charismatic and personable have a much tougher time. And whether that's fair or not, I can't tell you, but the goal is to build a business case that's appealing, and part of that package is the appeal of the people and the chemistry that goes on.
I ask that because in most cases we hear people, investors especially, talk about investing in the right team, because if it's a new product, if it's something that is likely to succeed, but we don't know if it's going to succeed, there is a chance that things will fall apart. And the team goes a long way, because a charismatic team can move through the harder parts of the entrepreneurship better, pivot, and find themselves in a different product with the same investor later on, right?
So, you know, there's this mythology that exists, that, you know, successful companies start off being successful and just get more successful. And the simple reality is companies try things, a lot of things don't work, and it's based on the caliber of the team to deal with problems and issues. And when stuff hits the fan, and it will, and it does, you know, you're depending on the caliber of the team that they can step back and say, okay, we have a problem. How are you going to fix it? And instead of dwelling on the problem, they come together and they figure out how to move the company forward. And in saying that, you say, well, that's not hard. But in fact, a lot of teams can't do it. And they can't do it because they don't have the leadership, they don't individually have the skill set, and finding that team who can figure out how to make things work when they're not working is really a key aspect, because very few businesses hit the target the first time. Something goes wrong, they're going after the wrong product, the wrong market, they have competitive threats. And all of those things are things that can sink any company, and often do.
And in the startup world, and I'm wondering, is this your opinion? We often hear people saying, so if you're running your first startup company, you're bound to fail. So is it like that? Should people prepare that the first thing they try to do as a business will fail? And then when they learn from their mistakes, they will do better?
The answer is no, and I need to explain that. The simple fact is, if you focus on failure, you will fail.
Yep.
And that applies to entrepreneurs, and interestingly enough, it applies to investors, and I want to explain why. Because if you think it's going to fail, you never fully commit to the company, you don't quit your second job, and so you're not devoting full time on the business, and you're just not into it the way you need to be. And in the same way, I meet investors who don't necessarily believe the company will succeed, in fact, think it may fail. So they never give the company enough time, they never give the company enough money, so they have a chance to succeed, to hire the right people, to do the things that take time and take money. And that's one of the key differences that I find between successful startups and unsuccessful startups. Focus on success. You may not succeed, but if you're constantly focusing on failure, you absolutely will fail.
Yes, basically, I totally agree, because you shouldn't focus on failure like that. I watched recently a movie, I don't know if you've seen it, Startup Kids. It was produced by a team from Norway, and they were doing startup stories from guys from SoundCloud and a lot of other startups. And one guy said, so see all of these people in the room? At one point, they all burned their businesses. And if they didn't, they will burn this one. So thinking like that, and thinking in the mentality of my business will fail if it's my first business, then why should we ever go into that? On the other hand, we learn from the mistakes, right? So we shouldn't be afraid to make mistakes.
We learn from mistakes. You know, a startup is a grand experiment, and you succeed, fail, or run out of money. But the fact is that, yes, a lot of startups fail, and you know, there are first-time entrepreneurs who are wildly successful, and frankly, on the second business, they are wildly unsuccessful. And you know, more experience is better than less experience, but smart people who surround themselves with great co-founders and members of the team, who find advisors and mentors to give them help and advice, who ask good questions, those are all recipes for success. And if you will do those things, and then you have, you know, the wild card, which is timing. Is this the right time? You know, are you in the right place at the right time? Those things you can't control. But for the things you can control, a lot of people don't realize that they can increase their chances of success, whether they are first-time entrepreneur or not.
In one of the previous episodes of the podcast, we mentioned one interesting thing one of my guests did. And basically, they said, so an entrepreneur builds a business. And the key to an entrepreneur is building that business, raising it up, going through the rough times. At one point, every entrepreneur, if he is or she is successful, creates a job for themselves in a big company, if the company grows to be that big. And he is no longer an entrepreneur per se. So he's no longer in a day-to-day risk situation in that sense. So in the startup world, from your experience as an investor and going through startups, so how many entrepreneurs really, you know, are in it only for the thrill of building a business? So they build a company in order to sell it and then going to another project or remain in the big company.
Right. So the most successful entrepreneurs are usually people who are not in it for the money, but they're committed to something. They're committed to changing the world. They're committed to building a better product. They're committed to something. And it's bigger and in a lot of ways much more important than money. And that's not to say that they're not happy when they make a lot of money. But what I also find, and this is a phenomena more so in Silicon Valley than in other parts of the US or other parts of the world, is that a lot of people who start a company and it's successful, or even if it's not, they want to do it again and again and again and again. There's a kick, there's a thrill that people get from taking nothing, taking an idea, bringing people together, and creating something that helps people, that changes the world, that satisfies a need in the marketplace. And that's why you often see people who have been very successful go and start another company and another company after that. It's not for the money. Mm. There's something bigger and more important for them, and it's what really motivates a lot of the more successful people in Silicon Valley and everywhere around the world.
And how many people, when we're talking about, you know, creating another company, so how many people you see running startups which did not yet reach that amount of success already go into a side hustle? So a side business. So how many people start multiple businesses at the same time? Just because there can be different reasons. So one isn't as going as fast as they would like them to, and there is not that much success. We need more money and we can't get investments, so we're going to do a side hustle.
Okay, so in the startup world, in the venture capital world, most investors will not invest in somebody who's not 110% committed to that one company. The only person who comes to mind who is running multiple companies at the same time is Elon Musk and from Tesla and the Boring Company, and he's got several others, and then Jack Dorsey of Twitter and Square. And those are not necessarily examples one would want to follow.
Okay, so you
is that controversial enough?
Yeah, cool. So we need to mention them in the sharing of the podcast. So you mentioned in one of your talks that the easiest time to raise money is when you don't need it.
Mm-hmm.
So can you touch on that?
Well, so I meet entrepreneurs all the time who tell me, if I get this big order, if this contract happens, if this whatever happens, I don't need to raise money. And that's the time I take a very big stick or a hammer and I want to hit them over the head. And why do I want to hit them over the head? Because the simple fact is, when you don't get that big order, when things aren't going well, nobody's going to invest in your company. People want to invest when things are going well. So when things are going well, even though it's counterintuitive, when you don't need the money, that's when people will give you money. And it's the piece that's the blind spot for so many entrepreneurs. And so if there's nothing else people remember from me or this podcast, remember, raise money when you don't need it. Because when you desperately need it, nobody's going to give it to you. Because when you desperately need it, it means that things aren't going well.
And that's an excellent point, which everybody should remember. I'm going to expand on that and ask you, should everybody raise money even if they don't need to. So for example, is it better for a company if they can push or bootstrap a product and whatever their business is, to go in the course of investments, no matter if they need it or don't? Not?
So, you know, that's one of those questions where the answer is it depends. Mm-hmm. It depends on a lot of things. I don't advocate that people should take venture capital. Mm-hmm. I think there are some businesses, some industries, where having access to capital allows you to do things which give you a competitive advantage, whether it's building sales and distribution channel, you know, building out your product roadmap, doing things that may give you a significant strategic advantage. There are other times you raise capital because your customers are concerned about, are you going to be around? There are other times you raise capital because your competitors have raised capital and you need it as a competitive weapon, as a competitive tool. So, raising money, if you can't use it, just dilutes your ownership. And there are some businesses that generate enough cash, have enough predictability in their revenue stream. Throwing additional money in really doesn't do anything. And for those companies, generally you say don't raise capital. But for companies where there may be a need to raise capital, that can be operational, that can be strategic, that can be customer related, then consider raising capital.
Okay. You are one of the co-authors of a book called Decoding Silicon Valley.
We're going to... The Insider's Guide.
The Insider's Guide. So we're going to put an Amazon link in the description of the podcast so everybody can check it out. And this book, it empowers startups all over the world to burst the myth that success is only related to people or startups in Silicon Valley. So everybody can have success whether they are in Silicon Valley or not.
That's correct. I think it's important that, you know, there's this mythology that the only place to start a company is Silicon Valley. Mm-hmm. It's not true. There are certain companies, some in certain industries, where the critical mass of talent or customers or capital that you need are in Silicon Valley or maybe elsewhere in the US or maybe elsewhere in the world. What we wanted to do was to give people an understanding of Silicon Valley, how it works, and more importantly, to help people understand the best practices for building successful businesses wherever they are.
So what brought about writing this book?
So my co-author, Michelle, had an idea for a book about 5 or 6 years ago, and we talked about it, and we talked about it. And just like entrepreneurs talk about ideas and never do anything, it was an idea that nothing ever happened. And in working with startups all over the world, we saw where people's understanding of how Silicon Valley worked was lacking, that people would come to Silicon Valley unprepared, people had unrealistic expectations. There were a lot of things that we felt we were spending a lot of time trying to bring people up to speed on. And so we saw the need, and finally we sat down and decided, originally Michelle was going to write the book, and then she said, can you give me some help? And I said, sure. And then she finally came back to me and said, if we don't write this book together, it's never going to get written. And so we sat in a conference room for about a year and a half, and we wrote the book. And it was a great learning experience for us, and it's certainly been a great experience now sharing that, our knowledge and our experience with entrepreneurs all over the world.
Fantastic. And you go around the world helping entrepreneurs and startups build their businesses and develop their strategies and everything. So this podcast is called The Backward Entrepreneur because it is intended for all business owners who target the global marketplace, because no matter where you are, whether you're in Africa, Europe, US, if you're targeting the global marketplace, you can consider yourself in some kind of a backwater. So according to the global marketplace, in relation
well,
to the global marketplace.
I prefer not to make judgments. I would say, you know, that there are smart people everywhere in the world. There are great opportunities all over the world. And, you know, the challenge for everybody is figure out how do you build local, regional, or global success. It's hard everywhere. Mm-hmm. The challenges in starting and being successful in Silicon Valley are different than growing and building a successful company in Belgrade, Serbia, or Cairo, Egypt, or Seoul, Korea. And so you look and say, you know, what are the things one can learn and how can you go about bobbing and weaving in order to build success?
What would be your one advice or two advice for people who do services or product, but are, as I said, so in the backwater. So for example, we are here in Serbia, we sell, the target place is US or anywhere else in the world, or the US and the target market is China, whatever it is. So what is your advice for a small entrepreneur who is targeting somewhere which is not near them, they cannot build through their, you know, as we say, social circles. So when we do crowdfunding, you start with your own social circle and then expand on their social circle and so on and so forth. So, but my immediate target market is somewhere over there. What would your advice be for them?
Well, generally,
what to focus on mostly?
So, well, I would say generally, you know, if you don't have a local market, if you don't have an opportunity to test and validate and get the market feedback that you need locally, it's going to be much harder to successfully figure out the market and build the right product for that market that's far away. And so my advice to people would be find a business opportunity that you can develop and test locally and then go to larger markets. And if that means you build a different product or go after a different market or physically pick yourself up and move somewhere else, you know, that's probably going to increase your chances of success. And so really thinking long and hard about what you build and where you build it is one of the messages I communicate to entrepreneurs. Because if you don't have the access to the talent, you don't have the access to the market, you don't have the access to the capital you need, you don't have access to the infrastructure, it's really going to be a lot harder to build success both locally, regionally, and globally. Do the things that are increase your chances of success.
Fantastic. And with that, we're going to come to an end to this podcast. John, thank you very much for being a guest on our show, Backwater Entrepreneur. And I hope that we will see each other again soon.
It's a deal. Thanks very much.
Thank you, everybody. And see you on the next episode of the show. Talk to you soon.